This is a Silver Bullet Security Podcast with Gary McGraw. I'm your host, Gary McGraw, CTO of Cigital and author of Software Security. This podcast series is co-sponsored by Cigital and IEEE Security and Privacy Magazine, where a portion of this interview will appear in print. For more, see www.computer.org/security and www.cigital.com/silverbullet. This is the 35th in a series of interviews with security gurus and other types, and I'm pleased to have with me here today Daniel Suarez. Hi, Daniel.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
So Daniel Suarez, a.k.a. Leonid Zaras?
Zaras. And this is one of those things where how could there be a pronunciation because it's a fake name?
There you go.
Your pronunciation is as valid as mine.
And my name would be Erag Wargickum in that case. Is an independent consultant to Fortune 1000 companies. For 17 years, he's consulted to defense, finance, and entertainment companies. An avid gamer and technologist, Daniel lives in Glendale, California, with his wife, Michelle Seitz, who's a fellow geek. And Daniel wrote an amazing novel called The Demon, which I read in a self-published edition last summer. And this is one of those books, kind of like Snow Crash, that will change your view of technology. Dutton published the book January 8th, and DreamWorks has options on it, apparently, for a movie. And Daniel...
Yeah, it's Paramount now. It's Paramount.
Because, oh, it's Paramount. Everybody's buying the rights, huh?
Well, no. What happened was the principals left DreamWorks, the Spielberg, Katzenberg, and Geffen, and they started DreamWorks 2.
Gotcha.
And the property was moved over to Paramount. And that's what Hollywood does.
There you go. So, and most importantly of all, Daniel is an English lit major. So, so you've gone from self-published to mentioned in Time magazine last week. What was that
crazy.
Like, and how does that feel?
I've started just imagining it that this is somebody else and not me. You know, I was actually on last call with Carson Daly last night on NBC, and they interviewed me, and I watched it, and it is surreal. You look at it like, who's that guy? But I just shrug it off. I mean, you've been on television a lot, so you actually gave me some good forewarning of this, where they just put you in this cubbyhole.
Yeah,
I was
right.
Also on the Glenn Beck show, and you have no warning that the camera is on or that you're on the air. You just have to pay close attention.
Did they stick a person in your ear? That makes it doubly confusing.
That's exactly what they did, and there was a second and a half delay as well.
Oh, man. I love when they say, cut to question four, you have 15 seconds. You're like, what the heck?
Much like that. It's like, you know, this is the first time I've been on the air. And, of course, there's nobody on the soundstage because it's completely automated.
So one of the things you might notice later on, and I got this from talking to my grad school advisor, who's Doug Hofstetter, he said that he had a whole persona named Douglas R. Hofstetter, who, you know, that was the guy who wrote all those books like Go to Lesher Bach, and then there was Doug, and they were two different entirely different people, because your image gets so big out there that regardless of what you're like, it gets separate.
That makes sense to me now, and I bet a year ago that wouldn't have made much sense, but I get that now, because it's true. I mean, of course, right now I'm being myself, because, you know, I like to think I know you, but when you're doing the television thing, you basically become the pundit.
You know?
And then when it's over, you go back to being just yourself.
So the book is doing well, looks like, and that's great. And the reason I wanted to talk to you about it on Silver Bullet is because you have this really interesting mix of AI and computer security and other high-tech stuff and lots of great ideas about distributed attacks sprinkled all throughout the book, and so it's something that I wanted to talk to you about in a little bit more detail. The virtual protagonist in your book is this dead guy, Matthew Sobel, who's a game designer. And I guess MMORPGs play a role as a recruiting mechanism in the book for the distributed program behind much of the plot.
And that's right. That's one vector anyway,
Yeah, and I guess that the MMORPG in the book is called The Gate. So
that's right.
So let's talk a little bit about MMORPGs as recruiting grounds for technical sophisticates or disenfranchised 20-year-olds or whatever else you want to call.
That's right.
Where did this idea come from, and do you think that it has kind of a realistic possibilities in the world that we live in today?
Yeah, you know, I would be surprised if this type of thing isn't happening. And once again, to really encapsulate it, what is portrayed partly in the book is exactly that, people organizing and meeting one another and combining skills, let's say, that individually they would not be effective, but by combining with people in far-flung locales through these virtual games, they can start to create cohesive, effective units that can begin to affect, in this case, very dangerous tasks. So I think, especially when you look at surveillance of phone calls, searching for keywords, but when people talk in games, mm-hmm. you know, even though they're mostly just talking trash to each other, it is conceivable that people could meet in some dark corner of some fictitious world and plan activities in the real world.
So it's kind of like just a communications channel, really.
Correct. Although, as a training mechanism as well, it mm-hmm. occurred to me that if you were to create a mock-up, and of course the military uses this when it comes to training people for special ops missions and other things, where they create the virtual environment for them to go so they can rehearse again and again and again and go through the assault or the hostage rescue or something,
mm-hmm.
you could just as easily build a custom level to do similar things with a much lower budget.
I think there was a little dust-up over Al-Qaeda doing something like that in Second Life last year, if I recall.
Yeah, and another one in World of Warcraft. And, of course, I look at that stuff and I think, well, sure.
It's almost eye-roll-inducing, isn't it?
Exactly. Because that's not necessarily what I'm saying. And, you know, when I hear the Al-Qaeda thing, and some people have brought that up to me, that's not really what I'm saying.
Uh-huh.
What I wanted to do in this book was to try to portray this scenario where a complex series of events could be managed by a less than human intelligence bot.
Right.
That you basically, it's looking for these benchmarks and it really doesn't care about how you feel today or anything else. And if you fail in your task, 100 other people might not.
Yeah, and I think the things that happen in the plot, the kind of monitoring and then action, are things that probably could be carried out with a simple classifier system. If you want to think about AIs.
Yeah, and that, to me, was the key differentiator for this story versus another story where it has this super intelligent bot or artificial intelligence that is governing everything and is about to take over the world.
Yeah, meta-human. Yep, right.
Yeah, I wanted to have it be more like we would hardly even notice.
I think that's what makes it so damn scary and so damn compelling because of that.
That's what I was going for.
I guess you wrote a weather system for MMORPGs once that you sold for a while. And so the question is, are you like Matthew Sobel?
I assure you I'm not, but of course that's what he'd say. No, I am definitely not as smart as him. That software application I did, WeatherMaster is what it was what it was called, it was nowhere near as sophisticated as a full-on MMORPG. And in fact, it was designed for good old pen and paper role-playing gamers.
Oh, interesting.
Avalon Hill gamers. It was a companion, too. But it did have a really kick-ass orbital mechanics module, which was awesome.
Cool. So one of the most interesting scenes in the book, from my perspective, happens when the demon goes after spammers and tries to wipe them out. And the thing, not only was that amusing, but I really loved this notion of what you might call a distributed emergent attack, where, you know, there were actors, human actors, in the attack, but they really didn't necessarily have any idea what role they were playing in the entire emergent attack. Just absolutely fantastic. And so I wanted to ask you, do you think those kinds of situations, you know, with lots of clueless participants working together like ants in an ant colony, happen in real life?
See, that I wonder about. I think it will become clear whether they do in coming years.
Mm-hmm.
But I look at this, the book, of course, uses real technologies. I'm just combining them in what I think are new ways. Since there's no barrier, there's nothing to this in reality.
If
you look at the great breadth of the world, I would be stunned if they're not happening somewhere. I mean, flash moms or smart moms were just the beginning of that. And rather than, in this case, doing some performance art piece where everybody shows up at one spot with umbrellas and opens them, what would prevent them, especially if there was some funding behind it, for doing something much more nefarious without people realizing what they're doing?
Well, it was just, that was fantastic. I mean, that is a darn scary thing. And I think if, say, spy masters are not doing that sort of distributed spying today, they're crazy.
Yeah. Doesn't it seem like it would be cost effective? I'm sure it would.
Absolutely.
Now, Bruce Sterling, I think he did... I won't say something similar, but in his book Distraction, and you know, it's funny, after my book was out, somebody pointed this out to me, so I went and read it, and he had some servers that were somewhere in Latin America, and what they would do is if somebody wanted to get rid of a politician, they would start sending out all this spam saying, hey, you got to kill this politician, in the hopes that somewhere in the world there'd be somebody wacko enough to listen.
I think that your thing is way more sophisticated than that. I mean, the notion of, say, assembling a weapon out of seemingly innocuous parts and
I can't wait
to see that in film. That is just so cool. When I read that, I was just psyched.
Well, yeah, I'm confident that they'll do a decent job on the film because they we've talked about that scene in particular. So I think if it gets made, which looks good right now, I think that will definitely make it in.
That'll
film.
Be my favorite scene. I already know ahead of time. So do you know the book Halting State? Did you ever read that one?
I do, Charles Strauss, and I am going to get it. The reason I'm not reading it now is because I'm finishing up my sequel, and I don't want it poisoning the well, so to speak. I'm going to write what I'm going to write, and then when I'm done, I'm going to pick it up and read that because people have told me I should.
Yeah, there's some interesting spycraft kind of applications of the distributed attack idea. It's not quite the same, but really interesting. It seems like if you're a Kuhnian, you know, the time is now for that paradigm to shift to that. So
doesn't it seem that way?
It really does.
Some people have asked me whether, you know, I know I'm helping the enemy. You know, and I always laugh about that because it's that old obscurity argument, which is that most people, you know, and by that I mean people walking the street, aren't aware of this revolution that's taking place in technology, how we're reaching a critical mass where all of these interconnections are really going to start changing things.
Right. Well, as we all know, the future is not evenly distributed, right?
Yes, exactly. It's here now. William Gibson, that's very good. And I just wanted to try to spread awareness of it a little more because, you know, who in the public would read a nonfiction book about this topic or a white paper? And I think the answer is no one.
Right.
So by making it a thriller, the idea is, and if I huge to a very realistic line, hopefully people would get something useful out of it at the same time that they're being entertained.
Cool. So you use the term bot a lot in your speaking about the book and thinking about it. And this word means different things to computer security people.
Yeah, it does. And
like
I took
19
some liberties there
things.
Only to make it streamlined.
Well, like 19 different things to even computer security people. So I'm wondering if you can explain how your work combines bot as in botnet and bot as in gamebot together.
And if you're referring to my bot-mediated reality presentation
that
I did
probably.
Up in San Francisco?
Yeah, the long now thing, yeah.
Yeah, what I did there was I talked about the implications of a society that is automated, that has these very simple bots that are all specialized, bred, you know, designed to do thousands and thousands of specialized tasks individually, and how by reacting and interacting with each other, that it's not so much complexity as it is starting to squeeze us out of our decision-making capacity, our seat of control of society, because we're ceding more and more control, we're deferring to what algorithms tell us to do. And that doesn't sound earth-shattering on its own, but one of the things that I did in the presentation was start to identify specific areas of society where this is occurring. And one of my favorites in that was a photograph, and I think it was from the Chinese Olympics, which showed a sign, a banner, that was written in English, and it said in bold letters, "Translation error." And it's because somebody had just trusted. You know, they put in the Chinese characters, and so as English people got off the plane, they could see, you know, instead of welcome, it's just "translation error."
I think that's actually the name of a rap star.
There you go, that's a good one. But that was you take that and you extrapolate from there. and instead you have it be the financial strategy of a large multinational corporation being governed by an algorithm that a few people wrote, and maybe they're no longer with the company.
Yep.
And you can start to see how very simple bots really have direct control of the, well, I don't want to say destiny, but the opportunities of people in the real world. And
right,
that's where
right.
I was heading with that. So right. when I say bots, I have, you know, some people have said to me, well, you know, we also call those programs. That may be true, and it may be very exact nomenclatures for these things.
Well, I think it's okay to say bot in terms of game bot there. That's like a game bot. And then if you're going to make them do nefarious things, you need them to be like a bot is in botnet by being stealthy, you know, or being rootkit.
And you were talking about game bots, and that is in these online games that people are automating the game playing process. And actually these avatars, which look in the game world indistinguishable from human beings who also have avatars, you're then directly competing for resources in these virtual worlds. So I explored that as well as a frontier for what we might be looking at a few years down the road in reality.
Mm-hmm. So we've already mentioned this, but this is worth another mention. One of the things I love about your book is its use of real science and technology that's at the cutting edge. And so you use hypersonic sound, laser-induced plasma channel weapons, autonomous vehicles, fab labs, rootkits. I guess you really are a geek, aren't you?
Oh, I am very much so. I love that stuff. And it you know, when you read a techno thriller or something, and I won't name names, but and they just kind of don't even try. You know, they phone it. That always bothered me because I like the story, and then they want, you know, they go off a cliff, and they just.
I shouldn't say this, but I find Crichton that way, frankly.
Yeah, you know, and I know he's recently deceased, so I will just not say it.
You're nicer than I am, I suppose. So I'm a little bit less optimistic about AI than you seem to be, but maybe we can explain it.
Because, and I seem optimistic?
Well, you're talking about micro AI. I suppose, you know, you could assemble these
right.
micro AIs into something that maybe passes the Turing test. But, you know, maybe it's because I got a PhD trying to make a machine do something really simple, which turned out to be extremely hard.
You know, that doesn't surprise me. But I will say this. I think we're approaching the Turing test from the opposite direction in that I think, and this is going to sound terrible, we're getting dumber. Not the machines are getting. So basically,
so as long as the judge is a 13-year-old who watches American Idol
right.
all day, we're in good shape.
And who writes in dude speak,
there
then it's
go.
Easy, you know, but not easy. But I think there's a little downward pressure on that because the nature of communications, human intercommunications now, I think the prime incentive is speed
mm-hmm.
now, whereas in the 18th or 19th century it was to, have this detailed communication and write in this florid script. It's the opposite now. And people, well, you know how emails are now. It's just, boom, a few words. And I think that gets easier and easier for machines to mimic.
Yeah, it might. I think that one of the things I've noticed about email communication is that it can be emotionally ambiguous. And depending on the mood of the receiver, it can go one way or the other. And it might surprise you as the writer that there could even be multiple mappings of the same, you know, bits into emotions.
Yeah, and as much as I hate emoticons, I do use them on occasion for that reason.
Oh, gosh, I really, really hate them. I don't use them. Death to smileys.
yeah.
So, you know, do you think that some sort of dystopian imbalance, or you might put it this way, you might say node revolution, where were the nodes?
Oh, I like that. That's good.
Is inevitable?
Inevitable, no, I wouldn't think so. I do have a concern that in the pursuit of hyper-efficiency, we might cede both our control and our understanding of the inner workings of society. I always like to think of it, somebody launches a process or a series of processes where no individual is in control. Let's say it's spread across several major corporations.
Mm-hmm.
And then over time, people either forget how it runs, it becomes a black box, they simply have to trust that the quote-unquote high priests who preceded them were correct.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I think that's the way, my personal feeling would be that's the way it would happen, is sort of by degrees getting to the point where we are just trusting too much.
Yeah, images of Wall-E come to mind.
yeah, you know, I guess that's true, but that would be far-flung result of it. I think in the shorter term, I would be concerned about a society that looks exactly like the one we're in, but it's not primarily people making the decisions. And I think the great thing about humans is that we're very adaptable, very flexible. We're this very big brain generalist. And I think that's where our survival edge comes from. And if we get rid of that in pursuit of hyper-efficiency, then that makes us very brittle and, and more susceptible to collapse. I know, I'm a joy to hang around.
Well, there's another aspect of it, too, which is there's potential to kind of seize the reins that is now granted to the individual that before would take some sort of larger societal pressure.
Precisely. So there's this centralization at the same time that allows fewer people to control things. And then, of course, if you make it so that it's hard to tell humans from bots, what's to stop a bot from taking control?
Right.
And using humans to do their bidding. That was definitely one of my concerns.
So you mentioned that you're working on a sequel, which I hear is called Freedom.
Actually, it's called Freedom TM.
TM. I almost said the TM. Okay.
It's hard to say, I know, but I'm doing that for a reason, obviously.
It's got a cheese factor associated with it, you know. When you say TM, it's like cheese factor 10, but that's good, I think.
That's true. And so you can get away with just calling it Freedom. I think in print it'll work a little better.
So the
idea for me... Oh, go ahead.
When do we get to read that? That's the real question.
It's going to be early 2010. Mm-hmm. And originally I conceived this book really as these two books combined. It was one story, so this is not sort of an also-ran, like, oh, hey, this one worked, I'll do another one. Mm-hmm. I originally wrote these as a single work, but I think it was on page 1135 of the first book, and I started realizing, you know, I'm going to have this 1,000-page self-published novel. I mean, who the hell is going to buy that? So I chopped it in two and moved and restructured it and moved a lot of it into a second book. So finishing that, it was going to come out last November, but when Dutton, you know, purchased both books, they wanted to do a normal release schedule, which is separated by a year.
That's smart anyway for just building the wave perspective. So any cool technology things that you've put in there that you want to reveal? Not plot devices or new ideas, but, you know, kind of edgy science that you think is cool.
Oh, boy. Well, definitely you'll see some alternative energy issues. And I'm wondering if I want to reveal this in this conversation, but there is a device called a Razorback in the first book, and the swarming behavior and basically the ecology of that device will be much more elucidated in the second book.
Awesome. Very cool. So I also liked these other two books called Accelerando and Halting State, which I mentioned before, and I read them all around the same time this summer during No-Fly July. And so the question for you is, what techno thriller do you recommend after everybody has read The Demon?
Yeah, you know, I'd be probably the worst person to ask, because I've deliberately not read any techno thrillers while I'm writing them. And so I've got this pile of ones on one. And it's because I don't want to get into this situation. I honestly just want to be able to say, I wrote this because I was thinking it.
Exactly.
And then if later I go back, because otherwise you start to get in makes an impression on you, and you can't tell after a while.
Yeah.
So I want to keep it clean, my mind nice and clean, and then, you know, I'm reading lots of nonfiction. So there's one that just came out. I'm trying to remember. What is it called? There's one by P.W. Singer. Yeah, it's called Wired for War, The Robotics Revolution and the Conflict in the 21st Century.
So you do the opposite of what I do. When I'm writing a nonfiction book, I'll disallow myself from reading fiction, because I treat it as kind of like dessert. So I can only get to read fiction again once I finish my next book. Damn it.
Yeah. And that's more or less what I do. It's something similar, but because otherwise it tends to, you know, leak into your writing, or at least that's my theory.
Well, super. Thanks a lot for talking with us today. It's been really fun.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
This has been a Silver Bullet Security Podcast with Gary McGraw. Silver Bullet's co-sponsored by Cigital and IEEE Security and Privacy Magazine and syndicated by InformIT. The January-February 2009 issue of IEEE Security and Privacy Magazine examines the thorny issues invoked by an IT monoculture. The issue also features an in-depth look at security issues with Google's Android platform. Subscribe today at www.computer.org/security/BSI sub. Show links, notes, and an online discussion can be found on the Silver Bullet webpage at www.sigital.com/silverbullet. This is Gary McGraw.